You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When most Americans think of Afghanistan, the first things that come to mind are 9/11 and the war on terrorism. But there's much more to this Central Asian country story than U.S. involvement. Afghanistan has been called the graveyard of empires because of a long history of foreign powers meddling in its affairs, from Alexander the Great to the British during the 1800s, the Soviet occupation in 1979, and finally the deployment of American UN and NATO forces in 2001. Tamim Ansari, who was born and raised in Afghanistan and educated in Oregon, has written a comprehensive history of his native land called Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. It's published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
You talk about there being two different Afghanistans. What divides the country into two distinct parts?
You know, I think I'd say that because of the foreign powers always looming over this place, at some point in Afghan history, about 120 years ago, the usual impulse of Afghan history to go out and conquer India and Iran was stymied now because of these great powers. So the imperialist energy of, conquering militant, charismatic Afghan leaders turned inward. And the elite began to try to govern the country in a way that had never been done before. And the result was there is now a sort of a bureaucracy, centralized, operated from Kabul, Afghanistan, that lies over the whole country. And there is the grassroots, the crabgrass of local elders, clerics, and all that. And those are the two Afghanistans.
But couldn't we even add to that other Afghanistans? For example, there are so many different tribal groups. There are different languages spoken. There's the Sunni and Shiite divide as well.
Well, yes, there are. It's a conglomeration of ethnic groups, tribes, clans, all of that stuff. I will say that, Afghanistan has a continuous history. And if you talk to most people within that territory and you say, is there such a thing as Afghanistan, or are you just an Uzbek or a Tajik? Most people would say, oh, yeah, there is Afghanistan, and they would be not wanting to hear that perhaps it should be divided into a Uzbek and Tajik north and a Pashtun south. So there is that.
There is a sense of nationhood.
There is a sense of nationhood.
Well, how was it ruled before the British came in the 19th century? Others had been there. Alexander the Great, did he create some sense of unity? Did the Mughals later give the Afghans some sense of unity?
Well, when the Greeks came through, they left Greekism behind. And for about 200 years, there was a Greek state there. There were Greek kingdoms. And Afghanistan was a Greek place. They spoke Greek. They had temples. They had Aphrodite or whatever. When the Mughals came through, or the Mughals, if you're speaking of the Mughals, they went on through and conquered India and set up the Mughal Empire. But the local invasions, people were left behind and became the Afghans. That's what's happened until the West came along. Now, the West, the Russians only occupied, but they didn't mean to live there, and we don't either. We don't intend to go and colonize Afghanistan and live there. We just want to make sure that it serves the interests of the U.S. geopolitical situation.
Were there any notable kings or emirs prior to the arrival of the British?
Many. But the thing is, before the British arrived, the kings were not interested in really governing the people. People governed themselves. The framework of society was established by Islam, the Sharia. But when people there said Islam, they really meant some mixture of Islam and local custom and folkways, and they didn't distinguish so much. So that was the solvent, and then everyone pretty much lived their life in their own area. And the king just collected taxes, drafted some people, and went out to conquer more stuff. So,
to some degree, it sounds like today.
What?
Except for the conquering part, it sounds like today, doesn't it?
Well, it does sound like today.
The central government under Karzai.
Absolutely, because that's the rhythm of Afghan history. The original thing is fragmented, local, dispersed, and the attempt has been to congeal, coagulate, unify, centralize, and those impulses are always struggling. So it's always getting centralized, falling apart.
What part of Afghanistan are you from?
I was born in Kabul, and I spent 6 years in the town of Lashkargah, which was at that time the heart of the American development aid effort, and is now, I would say, the capital of Talibanism.
And since you speak English with an American accent, you must have come here fairly early. How did you wind up in the United States?
Well, actually, my English is without accent because my mother was American. She was the first American to marry an Afghan and go live in that country. So I have that. I also have I speak Farsi without an accent as well.
But I gather there has been a tradition of Afghan schools sending kids to American schools that goes back all the way to the 1920s.
Yeah, it goes back to the 1920s, and at that point, the developmentalists try to bring Afghanistan into the world. That impulse was dominant. So the kings of Afghanistan, the ruling elite of Afghanistan, they sent people like my father out to places like University of Chicago.
And when they came back, did they assume leadership roles?
They certainly did. You know, if you had a PhD from a Western university, then you were in line for having a high position in the Afghan government. It kind of didn't matter what your PhD was in.
So was there I'd imagine they brought Western ideas with them. Did that apply to education? Because right now there seems to be a tension between whether schools should be co-ed or not. Was that something that was resolved earlier in the 20th century?
It wasn't resolved. It's the issue that Afghanistan has been struggling over. And for about 30 years, it was slowly moving towards secular education, co-education, schooling for girls. And it got to a certain point, then these wars started, and now it's been reversed, and now we're starting to climb up again.
But the Taliban have made co-educational schools and schools for girls targets.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Because they represent the traditionalist impulse. You describe Afghan history as a swinging back and forth between progressive and traditionalist.
Yeah, and I would say that now in much of Afghanistan, because it's been through these wars and because the land has been in chaos, it's an environment in which some people do well. You know, chaos is conducive to some people. So that that's what the insurgency is, people who want to restore the chaos so they can rise to leadership in a local way.
My guest is Tamin Ansari, A-N-S-A-R-Y. His latest book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Why has Afghanistan attracted so much foreign attention throughout its history? What makes it such a valuable piece of real estate?
Really, it's the fact that it's where the line of scrimmage happens to fall. There's always a big power in the north, a big power in the south, a big power in the west, and Afghanistan is the exact place where those powers overlap. So geographically, from ancient times, the fact that these are the mountains from which conquerors would go down and sack the rich cities of India, it mattered who held those mountains.
And is that why the British wanted to gain control of Afghanistan? Were they afraid that someone was going to invade?
They certainly were, and that someone was Tsarist Russia. And Tsarist Russia was going to invade or was probably interested in that. And they wanted to occupy and control that country up to at least that northern river that now marks the northern boundary of Afghanistan.
Did the Afghans benefit from being in between these two warring superpowers?
They didn't benefit when it was the Brits. During the Cold War, when Tsarist Russia had been replaced by the Soviet Union and British India was no longer that, it was the U.S. and its allies. In that period, the ruling elite figured out a way to use neutrality to carve out a kind of a sovereignty and autonomy for Afghanistan and get money from both sides.
But how important was it that that neither Britain nor Russia were Muslims? Did that matter? Were they just seen as foreigners, or were they also seen as people who represented a whole different view of the world?
I think it was important to some extent that they were not Muslims. It wasn't as important, I think, as it is now. That the temper of that time was, well, other people have other customs. So the fact that they were not Muslims meant that their culture was not going to blend with Afghan culture and produce something new. But they could work together.
When was its border with what is now Pakistan determined? How did that happen?
Well, that was in about 1880, and it was right after one of these British invasion occupation things. And this second British occupation had ended in the usual way, the fragmentation of the country, the inability of Britain to govern it. So they said, hey, we're going to hand it over. And they found a strong man and said, you can have this country. And they sat down with that guy. And Mortimer Durand, the British India foreign minister, he drew a line and said, this is what I'd like to have as the southern line. And the Afghan king said, fine.
But the British have had a history of doing that sort of thing in the area. The partition of India into the two Pakistans really was done with that, with little thought about culture. The same thing happened here. Wasn't Peshawar, which is now part of Pakistan, wasn't that originally considered part of Afghanistan?
It was, and, you know, the Afghan Pashtun kings long had a sentimental attachment to absorbing Pakistan into their domains. And I'll tell you, in 2002, when I went to Peshawar, or I actually landed in Islamabad, some people I would call Pakistanis drove us to Peshawar, and someplace along the way they woke me up and said, welcome to Afghanistan. And I said, wait, did we go across the border? They said, we certainly did. And then we got to Peshawar. So, and that feeling persists.
Well, it's the fact that the Pashtuns are almost equally divided between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Doesn't that complicate the current situation, the current political situation?
Yes, it does. And this is another one of those, it swings back and forth things. At some points, that border was more distinct and more, you know, both sides accepted it. Right now, it's in a stage in which that border is becoming indistinct, and the fact that the people that straddle that line are actually even belong to the same clans, not just the same tribes. So it's not that clear where the country ends.
Has there ever been a call for some kind of Pashtun nation, you know, a breakoff, because it's quite obvious where that territory lies, and also Pashtun played such an important part in the development of the Taliban, didn't they?
Well, the southern and southeastern Pashtuns did, yes. There has been a ghost of an idea for a long time of a nation or a something called Pashtunistan, the land of the Pashtuns. It's been a point of contention whether that's a nationalist idea, let's make a separate nation, or has it been let's have Afghanistan include all of this stuff, or what? That's not been resolved.
Well, you said that earlier, that Afghanistan originally had territorial designs on what became Pakistan. Mm-hmm. What happened after partition and those borders became a little harder for a while? What kind of relationships did Pakistan and Afghanistan have at the start in 1947?
Well, at the start in 1947, Afghanistan refused to vote for Pakistan in the United Nations for the creation of Pakistan because they said they wouldn't do that until the Pashtunistan question was resolved. And on the Pakistani side, people said, there's a question? I don't think so. So Pakistan came into existence, but that border was contentious, and they were scrimmaging back and forth over it for the next 20 years.
And even today, there are people who say that much of Afghanistan's problems are the result of Pakistani politics.
Well, that's true. You said the Pashtuns were the group that spawned the Taliban. But actually, it was kind of the refugee Afghans living on the Pakistan side of the border. They happened to be many Pashtuns. It happened to be predominantly Pashtun because that's the area from which people were able to get there when they became refugees. And then Pakistan, the fact that it had 6 million refugees, Afghan refugees, it used that fact to sort of craft a force that would go into Afghanistan. That was the Taliban. That was the original Taliban.
My guest is Tamim Ansari, whose previous books are Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, and West of Kabul east of New York. There have been others as well. The most recent, Games Without Rules, the often interrupted history of Afghanistan. It is published by Public Affairs, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Tamim Ansari, whose latest book is Games Without Rules, the often interrupted history of Afghanistan, published by Public Affairs. You are the director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. How does that connect to the kinds of books you have written?
Well, it doesn't really connect. You know, the San Francisco Writers Workshop is this group that has been meeting since 1946. It long predates me. It's a free writing workshop. It's not really a workshop. It's a group. People drop in, they drop out, and it's been going all this time, and a lot of really good writers have flowed through there, and I'm one of the writers that have flowed through there.
And you just wound up becoming the director.
Yeah.
One of our listeners, Hugh, left this question on our show page. Did the British partition with little thought about culture or with an eye to fostering tensions that they could then capitalize on?
Well, I think my feeling is that they drew the line at the place where they thought they could hold the territory. In other words, they moved it as far forward as they thought they could hold it without trouble. That means they drew it at the line of scrimmage. So it always guaranteed that that's where the clashing and violence would be.
Another listener wonders whether the Afghan kings tried to take Peshawar back by force.
They really didn't. And the reason for that is that most of that time, the Afghan kings were in a sort of a collusion with the British. They had to negotiate between the British and their own people who really were interested in reconquering all that territory.
Why did the Khyber Pass become such a almost mythic place?
Well, you know, the Khyber Pass is a mythic image in my mind the first time I was there. It's just like this most impressive, you know, gap through impressive mountains I've ever seen. And it's the one place in that stretch of mountains that you can get from the plains of Pakistan to Kabul. So, you know, when I was there, I'll just tell you, you look up, you see mountains, you go, wow, those are big mountains. Then you look up and you say, whoa, there's another set of mountains. They're even bigger. Then you look up and say, what is that blue stuff? Is that clouds? And then you realize, no, those are even bigger mountains. So anyone going through that gap is vulnerable to people in the hills shooting down. And that's what makes it both, you know, good for ambushes, legendary, exciting, adventurous.
And protecting the country against invasion.
Yeah, although, you know, historically it's been occupied by smugglers.
Now, what was the political situation before the Soviet invasion?
Just before the Soviet invasion, this country was on its way to becoming, you know, raucously westernized. For about 15 years, they had entered on this new democracy movement. They had started to have elections. The king had withdrawn to a constitutional monarchy role. There was rock and roll in Kabul. There were nightclubs. There was just, you know, and then
it was one of the stopovers for Europeans who were making the trip through Asia.
Oh.
You go to Kabul, then you go to India, try to learn a little sitar, wind up in Kathmandu.
Yeah, and smoke a little hash when they were in Afghanistan. And those hippies that went through, they all have this image of Afghanistan as being the most mellow place. But then...
So why did the Soviets invade? Obviously, it wasn't simply because the place was mellow.
No. Well, what happened first is that a communist, Afghan communist group seized power. They overthrew the monarchy. They seized power. It was not a revolution. It was a one part of the ruling elite overthrowing another part of the ruling elite. And they wanted really to push this program of westernizing, secularizing, and centralizing the country much faster. And they encountered resistance. And I think, you know, the trigger for the Soviet invasion was, now it's a communist country, it's on our borders, and we can't let a communist country return to being non-communist once it is. So they invaded to protect the communist rule of Afghanistan. Then they got stuck, so the next 10 years happened.
It also led to many refugees crossing the border into Pakistan.
Yeah, and that was...
Why was that even necessary for those refugees?
Well, it was necessary because the Soviets, at some point around mid-80s, they decided that the only way they were going to win this war was to depopulate the countryside. That's where the insurgency was. They couldn't stamp it out. The insurgents were indistinguishable from the rural people, and they were being nourished by the rural people. So they said, okay, we'll get rid of the villages, the rural people, carpet bombing, landmines, you know, all that stuff. People left.
And were they treated well in the refugee camps by the Pakistanis?
Well, no. You know, they were in squalid tent cities, and the Pakistanis, when I was there in 2001 looking at those camps, the people were sort of in armed camps. They had wire around them. They were not allowed to work. They were not allowed to open businesses. But they were fed and given water. They were simple. The simple amenities of life were brought to them.
Well, did Pakistan see this as an opportunity to expand itself or to expand its power? Because Pakistan seems to me to be mostly focused, or has been mostly focused, on the tensions it has with India.
Well, you know, for one thing, now it occurs to me to say we shouldn't just say Pakistan, because Pakistan is a clamorous country with many factions and forces fighting. And so it's not just Pakistan that exploited the refugee camps. There is reactionary movements. There are reactionary movements in Pakistan. The ISI, the defense and, you know, the intelligence agency, the Ministry of Defense, there's people in there. They did see the refugees and the Mujahideen Afghans in their country as an opportunity to build a force that they could then use as a fifth column to go in once the opportunity came and take over the country.
So we've been talking about Pakistan, about the British, about the Russians, and then later the Soviet Union. What about the United States? How has U.S. policy shaped or Afghanistan or evolved over the years in relation to Afghanistan?
Well, you know, when I was I went in right after the Taliban were ousted, and that was in 2002. And
could you have gone back before?
Well, not safely.
You would have been seen as an enemy agent because of all the time you'd spent in the United States?
I didn't necessarily think about how I would be seen. It's just like it was a very dangerous place. Anyone might be killed there. You might think it's the same now, but it's actually not quite how it seems when you read the news, because all you see is suicide bombings, and there's a lot going on there. But in 2002, when the Americans first came in, Afghans that I met were euphoric about it. They thought the war was over. Americans were really going to fix this place.
So things, we messed up?
Well, it declined. Things got worse. And we probably made mistakes. I have to say that everything we've done, and we keep changing our policies and trying different things, everything they've done at one point or another was what I was saying, why are they doing this? They should do that. And then they try it and things would go bad.
Well, how important was the decision to put Hamid Karzai into a position of power?
Well, I think, and many Afghans think, that that was a mistake, because it was right at the beginning. They came in, they set up a traditional Afghan forum, which is called the Luya Jirga. And so it was, it seemed as if now they were going to let Afghanistan restore its, you know, its sovereignty. And the old king was there, and he was the one figure that Afghans probably would all look at and say, okay, we accept that this guy could be the leader of our country, because just tradition. But from the time that Luya Jirga opened, it was obvious that Karzai was going to be anointed. So when people came out of that Jirga, they didn't think it was a real Jirga, and the distrust of the U.S. may have started in there someplace.
Tamim Ansari, A-N-S-A-R-Y, is my guest. His latest book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many people believe that Pakistan played a major role in the development of the Taliban, supporting the continued support of the Taliban even after its ouster, despite the problems that it has had with its own Taliban. How implicated is the ISI in the whole situation?
Well, it seems to me and seems to many that it was completely implicated in the creation of the original Taliban. And that was the group that came in, fought, took over Kabul in 1996 and was ousted in 01, 02 by the U.S.
And did they see them as an extension of Pakistani goals?
Well, Pakistan hoped to use that Taliban to pursue its own geopolitical interests. They were in the role of foreign invaders of Afghanistan in the tradition of the British, the Soviets, and so on. Pakistan was the latest of those. But since then...
But they were using Pakistan. They were using Afghans to do it.
They were using Afghans to do it.
Like Mullah Omar.
Well, you know, as it turns out, however, the Afghans had their own agenda. And now Pakistan is in trouble with Talibanism. You know, not the Taliban, because the group has dissolved. It's fragmented. But the attitudes, the opinions, the energy, the insurgent guerrilla impulses that were unleashed there, it's as active in Pakistan as it is on this side. And you know, those Taliban insurgents in Pakistan captured the guy, the Pakistani defense intelligence official who had created them. They kidnapped him, they took him into the mountains someplace, and they killed him. So,
when the Taliban conquered the country, that was actually welcomed by people in the West as well. They saw it as a stabilizing force. But that quickly changed because the Taliban was just so repressive?
I don't know if I could say it quickly changed, you know. And I don't know if welcomed is the word either. I think it was
indifferent. Well, the Wall Street Journal said something like this is a good thing because there's pretty much chaos and anarchy in Afghanistan right now. You had Hekmatyar dropping mortar shells on Kabul because he was annoyed that he hadn't been given the power that he thought he deserved.
I like the word annoyed. That's a pretty light word to use for that. Certain places where the Taliban came in, the Afghans turned it over to them. It wasn't like the Taliban conquered southern Afghanistan. They just took Kandahar without a fight, Herat without a fight. And they did do the thing they said they were going to do. They gathered the weapons and brought some security. They didn't end the fighting. They never really did conquer Afghanistan. There was always continuing to fight with the old guerrillas. And I think the West, there were interests here that thought, well, these are the guys that are going to be able to stabilize the country. And it turned out not to be true. And then there was that incredibly regressive social program. And
they even blew up Buddhas because they were pagan images.
Right. That was they had an art program.
But was the situation that you described at the very beginning still in place here? You said the two Afghanistans were urban and rural. Was there resistance in all the major cities to the Taliban other than Kandahar?
No, because the Mujahideen, the earlier set of anti-Soviet guerrillas who ended up fighting each other, pretty much destroyed the cities. That's how the Taliban came in. Mm-hmm. You know, they depopulated the cities largely.
So where did the people in the cities go? Not just to the refugee camps in Pakistan.
No, there were IDP camps, you know, in internally displaced persons. The city of Kabul reduced to about, I don't know, 250,000 from 500,000 or something like that.
In your opinion, is there a way to unite the urban and rural populations into a single entity that would be more accepting of a really good national government?
You know, it requires that the war stop, and that requires that the nations surrounding Afghanistan come to some kind of agreement with each other to not interfere, to sort of respect the neutrality of the country. And then it'll require some time, and there will be some bad things that happen along the way. But Afghans can negotiate this amongst each other if they're not also dealing with this foreign incursion thing.
Is there any nostalgia for times in the past when there was progressive leadership like Amanullah's rule?
Well, Amanullah's rule...
I do mispronounce Afghan words.
Amanullah was a progressive, radically progressive king of the 1920s. And I don't think there is exactly nostalgia for his time. But the the dynasty that followed him tried to do that same progressive social movement that he tried to accomplish in like 5 years. They tried to do it over 45 years. And there is nostalgia for their time.
The Senate voted yesterday for an accelerated troop withdrawal until the end of 2014. Is that enough time to stabilize Afghanistan?
I think it's the nature of the question seems to suggest that the troops will stabilize Afghanistan, and we have to keep them there till they stabilize Afghanistan. I'm not sure that the presence of the troops is a stabilizing phenomenon in Afghanistan. You know, the insurgency has increased and spread almost mathematically correlatable to the rise in the number of NATO and U.S. troops in the country.
Now there's a whole other issue. Natural resources are attracting other countries. China, for example, is interested in its huge rare earth mineral deposits. There's also platinum, copper, and could the selling of Afghan mineral rights to foreigners like China buying up the rights to the world's second largest unmined copper vein for $3.5 billion lead to the next chapter in Afghanistan's history of civil unrest because of foreign influence?
Well, that has been suggested, yes. China has already secured the rights to the copper. India has secured the rights to the iron, which is also, there's a huge amount of that.
And that has to upset the Pakistanis.
That upsets the Pakistanis a great deal. And the question is, if there is a withdrawal of NATO and American forces, will China come in? It hasn't put troops in there at all yet. It doesn't have to. But will it bring troops in to protect its investments? That's the question.
Tamim Ansari, his book, Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. It's published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us
today. Well, thank you for having me.